Hello and welcome to Viewpoints. My name is Boris Chassaigne. I'll be with you for the next half hour. On today's Viewpoints, in British Columbia, young students learn to talk about how they feel and the issues they face.
A lot of the kids will say, like what I got from it, a lot of the people in my class think the same way as I do or have been through a lot of the same things as I have, where initially they thought they were on their own with these things. They were like, I'm not alone with it.
A farm located in Frilichburg, Quebec has been working for years to introduce niche organic Asian vegetables, and it works.
Growing Asian vegetables came to me as a logical project for me to reconnect with my culture.
In Halifax, the 200-year-old St. Mary's Cathedral Basilica will get a helping hand as it receives $380,000 in federal funding.
It's played pivotal roles in historical moments. Two world wars, two global pandemics, the Halifax explosion. It really is a remarkable institution that is part of the fabric of who we are here in Halifax.
And the unusual journey of Orianne Lee Johnson, a Cortes Island author who just published The Geography of Belonging, a love story, a memoir of her travels between Canada, Mozambique, and Zimbabwe.
Being there in post-colonial Zimbabwe shockingly opened my eyes to the blatant post-colonial racism and class systems that we do have here but that are not as obvious.
Happy to have you with us.
Follow us on Twitter at CanadaLJI. Listen to all our news online at canada-info.ca.
Our first stop is in Kitimat, BC, where a restorative justice program will work with grade 7 students to talk about things that may be new to them or tough to talk about. Lyle Cabery, a program director for victim services for the Kitimat RCMP, proposed the idea to the Mount Elizabeth Secondary School principal after a trial run at St. Anthony's Catholic School. The restorative justice program is a legal practice that brings victims and offenders together to reconcile with the help of a facilitator, but instead of working with victims and offenders, the program will gather grade 7 students in circles of 20 to have discussions relevant to them, like bullying and social media. This gets the kids to talk to each other about how certain things make them feel, giving them a new perspective. Students will also have a chance to talk about things that may be a new conversation for them, like sexual assault, consent, and substance abuse. More with Morgan Budin in Terrace, British Columbia.
A new restorative justice program will encourage grade 7 students at Mount Elizabeth Secondary School to confront important issues. Restorative justice is the legal practice of bringing victims and offenders together to reconcile with the assistance of a facilitator. Liesl Cabery is the program director for victim services in the Kitimat RCMP, who proposed the idea to the principal of the high school after seeing success during a trial run at another school. Cabery explained what the program involves and how it works.
So each time it's a different topic that we're focused on. When I go through, we start out with a light kind of game type thing, which encourages all the kids to start speaking and opening up. In the middle, we have some kind of another light kind of game. And then I get into some deeper questioning where we start with a less deep, easier one, then we go into a deeper one, and then we go into a deeper one, which encourages deep thinking and deep talking about things that they really feel.
A variety of topics are examined in the group, like bullying, social media, and consent, but Cabery explained the importance of identifying issues that are specific to the students.
The important thing is partnering, right? Like listening to the teachers, because they're the ones with them all the time, right? Being able to see what's going on in the classroom and what have you. You know, working with the school, because yeah, I'm not there, right? Like, so they need to guide me a little bit and what they think is important for the kids as well.
Cabery described the benefits she's witnessed from the kids having open discussions on topics that they can personally relate to.
More inclusive, more as united, because they were learning about each other and really learning about each other in a way that, you know, they probably don't think to learn as friends, right? Like asking pointed questions that they would not have normally done.
Kids were surprisingly honest about their situations when Cabery was doing a trial run of this program at St. Anthony's Catholic School. Cabery recounted the kids' feedback on how they felt this program helped them.
interesting for me, I hear back from them what they actually got from it. And a lot of the kids will say, like, what I got from it, a lot of the people in my class think the same way as I do, or have been through a lot of the same things as I have, where initially they thought they were on their own with these things. They were like, I'm not alone with it.
The grade sevens are scheduled to start the program in the new school year. Though if other teachers express interest in participating, Cabaret is hoping to get more people trained for the program to expand their reach.
Hi, I'm Pamela Hassan in Smithers, BC, and you are listening to Viewpoints.
We now turn to the province of Quebec, where Stephanie Wong, owner of L'Horizon Organic Farm, has been working since 2016 to introduce Asian organic vegetables to the region. Her farm is located in Frelishburg, Quebec. After growing up in Montreal, Wang came up with the idea when she began doing different internships on farms, including Les Jardins de la Grelinette in Saint-Armand. She officially launched L'Horizon in Quebec's eastern townships, and it has been growing ever since. Wang feels that she also needs to educate fellow farmers and consumers about how they grow and cook the products she now sells at different public markets as well as on her farm, so much that on Labor Day weekend she plans to hold an open house, an opportunity for the public to discover her farm, to discover a diverse selection of Asian vegetables and other products, to test them out and to learn how to incorporate them in everyday cooking. Our journalist Taylor McClure met up with Stephanie Wang in Knowlton, Quebec.
I discovered that I wanted to have an impact in the world, and I found that agriculture was a meaningful way for me to do it in terms of feeding people, in terms of taking care of the soil. Of course, growing Asian vegetables came to me as a logical project for me to reconnect with my culture while at the same time discover even new vegetables that I was not used to eat when I was young. So it really brings me to get to know more actually about my culture, to be more close with my family, with my community, but also to bring all of this knowledge and these kind of new foods to the local community and the people who are eager to discover new tastes, new colors, new vegetables in their plates, but also new vegetables in their gardens. So all the people that come to see us at the market are people who want to try something new. They have a lot of curiosity and open-mindedness, and I find it very stimulating to work in that context.
You're located in Frelishburg. You're from Montreal. How did you find yourself in this area, and how did L'Horizon get started?
When I started to be interested into agriculture, I started doing different kinds of work and internships in different farms. And one of the farms was Les Jardins de la Grelinette in Saint-Armand, from Jean Montelaine and Jean-Martin Fortier, who wrote Le Jardin Maraîcher. So it was a very model farm. It's a small scale farm where I could see that lifestyle is very important, that you can, you know, have a beautiful garden and have a small scale production, but live from it at the same time. So it was very inspiring. And then from there, they are in Saint-Armand. So I discovered the area here of Pont-Missisquoi and really fell in love with the place. And when I moved to Frelishburg, there was a farm, there was a guy, a trainer in permaculture, Bernard Alonso, who really believed in growing Asian vegetables here in Quebec because of their potential to extend the season, because a lot of the greens, they can tolerate cold weather, so they're very good to grow early in the spring, but also late in the fall. And he was seeking for someone to grow Asian vegetables. And I had the project in mind, but never thought that I would start it by myself. When I met him, I decided to start by myself and slowly. So I started in 2016.
What does this farming practice involve exactly? I'm not sure, like, if there's a different way of having to cultivate, to harvest. What makes this growing and harvesting organic Asian vegetables unique?
Yeah, that's a good question. Actually, in the past decade, a lot of pioneers have developed techniques in terms of organic agriculture, because this is what I believe in. We are certified organic since almost the beginning. So the techniques are pretty similar to growing any kind of vegetables in Quebec. The difference is mostly in terms of some harvesting techniques or stage of harvesting, and just to know how to harvest it, how to preserve it, and how to cook it, because you need to know it so that you can tell the customers how they will be able to eat it and enjoy it. So a lot of our work also involves bringing people to cook these vegetables, so giving a lot of ideas for recipes and how they can cook it, but in an easy way, so with accessible ingredients. Yeah, most of the time you can include all of those vegetables in the recipes that you already do, just to replace, for instance, the okra can be cooked like a green bean, and like amaranth leaves can be cooked like a Swiss chard. It's just to make those associations, I think, help people to include these vegetables in their diet.
Yeah, so le raisin almost has an educational aspect to it as well, to introduce people as to how they can include these vegetables in their everyday cooking.
Yes, exactly. I really enjoy this educational part, and we're pushing it. Actually, I wrote a book with my two sisters on growing and cooking Asian vegetables, as well as telling our family story through this. And the book will be released end of September, early October. We'll be announcing in the upcoming weeks a launching book event at our farm in October. Also, I'm working on a new website that is going to showcase also the different vegetables and products that we make, and also recipes and ways to enjoy them.
Taylor McClure was with Stephanie Wang in Knowlton, Quebec. St. Mary's Cathedral Basilica, the second oldest church in the country, will receive $387,000 in federal funding through the Canada Community Revitalization Fund. The funding will support upgrades to the basilica, which has stood on the Spring Garden Road since 1820. The basilica was named a National Historic Site of Canada in 1997. It has also played pivotal roles in historical moments, acting as a refuge during two world wars, two global pandemics, as well as the 1917 Halifax explosion. Father John Williams, rector of St. Mary's Cathedral Basilica, says the church will be working on restoring murals that were destroyed in that explosion, the 1917 explosion. They didn't know then how to restore them, so they painted over them. The Art Gallery of Nova Scotia is currently working on restoring the church's murals. More on this with Sarah Gouda in Halifax, Nova Scotia.
Well, good morning, everyone. I think we'll get underway now. It's a great pleasure to see everybody on this beautiful August morning in Halifax. My name is Andy Fillmore. I am the Member of Parliament here in Halifax, and I think everyone is through those meetings.
Hello, Andy. It is so good to see you again. How are you doing today?
I'm doing well, Sarah. It's nice to see you again as well. You're always very, very busy in our beautiful city.
Well, you have so much going on. So, Andy, tell us what we're doing here today.
So we're at St. Mary's Basilica in downtown Halifax, which is the home of the tallest granite spire on a church in North America. This church is more than two centuries old, and it serves a diverse population. That diverse population includes people that have different abilities. So what we've done today is provided federal funding in the amount of nearly $400,000 to allow the church to create an accessible elevator to move people from the main floor of the church down into the community space in the basement level, and to create accessible washrooms for people of all abilities. This is really important because, as I said, the church serves a diverse community. The funding is coming from a program called the Canada Community Revitalization Fund, CCRF, that we created during COVID as a way to bring community members back together again, to re-socialize and bring people together in a way that, you know, is uplifting and also delivers the services that people need. So in this case, the CCRF funding has helped to create an accessible community space that is serving this population of those either in housing or need or food insecurity need. in a hospitable way and allowing the church to exercise its mandate.
And can you share with us a little bit of history about this cathedral? I know you mentioned it in your speech, but I'm going to ask you to do it again.
Sure. Yeah. Well, it's a granite church. The spire itself is 200 feet. It soars into the sky, and untold thousands of visitors have marveled at it over two centuries. It really is a remarkable piece of architecture. It takes its name from St. Mary. And was, as we learned from Father John earlier today, was given the distinction of being named a basilica in the middle of the last century. The original building was built around 1820. It was expanded significantly rearward, extended to the rear or to the north in about 1860. New windows, a new apse was built. Inside, there are remarkable murals that had been whitewashed over sometime in the last century, and a art restorer has been retained who has painstakingly revealed these beautiful murals in the apse that are so clearly visible today. Likewise, there's been some restoration on the historic stained glass windows. More work to do there, but a good start is underway. This church, the Basilica, has played a role in the lives of the kind of the day-to-day lives of Haligonians for two centuries. But just as importantly, it's played pivotal roles in historical moments. As you said, two world wars, two global pandemics, the Halifax explosion. It goes on and on. This has been a place of refuge and a place of support for Haligonians and visitors to our city for all of those 200 years. It really is a remarkable institution that is part of the fabric of who we are here in Halifax. I was really pleased to meet Cameron, who's the Canada Summer Job student, who's been running tours in the Basilica for the last 7 years. I'm not sure if he's a DAL student, but that program is for students in Halifax. And it's an example of the contribution that students in the city are making to important institutions like this one.
I'm Lena Metledge-Diab. I'm the Member of Parliament for Halifax West, and I'm here today to announce on behalf of ECOWA some funding from the Government of Canada to the foundation, the Basilica Foundation that runs... you know, basically a kitchen for people, but also it's for upgrades, renovation upgrades for an elevator and accessibility.
And why is this basilica important? What is its significance?
So historically, the significant it's very significant. Historically, it's the second oldest church in Canada, after one in Quebec. But also during, as we heard today, both world wars, it really ministered to people in need that were coming on ships, that had diseases, that had nowhere else to go. And that ministry's continued, and it continues to minister to all people in need, particularly when I was here a number of years ago and I volunteered in their soup kitchen. It's feeding people without any questions, without any, you know, it doesn't matter who you are. If you're in need, you just come through those doors. And, you know, making it more accessible is wonderful to allow people of all mobility to come in. But it's right here in the heart of our city.
And how old is the Basilica?
1820. Construction started in 1820, so it's over 200 years old. 2 years ago, it celebrated 200 years. Yeah.
And what are your upcoming projects that you're currently working on?
So as a member of Parliament, of course, I am working with many groups in my community to help them on this Canada Community Revitalization Fund to upgrade facilities.
Thank you so much. Is there anything else you would like to add for Dalhousie audiences?
I tell you, Dalhousie's been a terrific partner, particularly the students and the people that are at Dalhousie. There's been a number of Dal students that have come and helped and volunteered here where we're standing, but also in many sites across the province and supported by raising money or raising funds. I can remember when I was a student many moons ago, but also when my kids were students as well. And, you know, it's wonderful that students are doing that because they care about their community.
I'm Father John Williams. I'm the former Vicar General for the Archdiocese and the former rector of this basilica.
You were just telling me about these beautiful murals. Can you share some information about them?
Yes, the murals were a significant artistic moment in the cathedral's presence. They were destroyed in the explosion of 1917, and they didn't know how to restore them, so they painted over them. And then 3 years ago, I contacted the Art Gallery of Nova Scotia and had an artist who came and is still working on them, and there they are today.
Wow.
But they were hidden from view for all those years, since over 100 years.
Hi, I'm Sarah Gouda in Halifax, Nova Scotia. You are tuned to Viewpoints. Listen to all our stories online at canada-info.ca and follow us on Twitter at CanadaLJI.
Back in BC, where first-time author Orianne Lee Johnston just published The Geography of Belonging, a Love Story. And to go with her book, she also produced a three-hour-long music playlist on Spotify to accompany readers as they turn the pages of her full-length work. The book is a memoir taking place in Zimbabwe and coastal British Columbia, portraying her experiences and reflections on working with horses, playing music, building relationships, observing various cultures, and her own place in contemporary society. Johnston has been living on Cortes Island for more than three decades and worked for several years as program director at Hollyhock Leadership Learning Center. Little did she know, years later, she would find herself living in Mozambique and Zimbabwe, doing volunteer work with horses and people. Johnston sits down with our Cortes Island journalist, Craig Osoba, to explore her inspiration and insights.
The book takes place between Zimbabwe in southern Africa in present day and here on the coast of Canada, where I was born in BC and where I've lived on Cortes for so long and where my family is. So it's a kind of, it's a cross transcultural love story, as I fell in love in Africa. And being there in post-colonial Zimbabwe shockingly opened my eyes to the blatant post-colonial racism and class systems, blatant, that we do have here, but that are not as obvious.
So is this, in a sense, a bit of a memoir or an autobiography?
Exactly. It's a memoir.
Okay.
And it spans a period of time in 2010 when I went to Africa after some major life change, leaving the long-time position at Hollyhock where you and I were together, and a long-time relationship completed itself, and had been a bit of a dark night, and then I was ready for a big adventure. And the story will say how I wound up on the coast of Mozambique volunteering with horses.
And of course, we've spoken before about your work with the horses. So what do you feel, what are you hoping readers will take away from the reading your book?
I've given that some thought, and there's actually three or four very particular things. Once I had written it and in the process of writing it, in the first couple of years that I was there, and I would ask my friends in the village and in the city, both Black Africans and White Africans, as they call themselves, what can I do as one foreign visitor? And to a person, they said, you can show the world that Zimbabwe is beautiful, that our hearts are full, and you can, in whatever way, let people know that this is a beautiful place, because the news is mostly about all the desperation in Africa, which is certainly there, the poverty, the disease, the death rates, the politics, the corruption, the drought, all of those things.
And not to mention an ancient and vibrant culture.
Exactly. You and I share, coming out of the Ba Tunde Ola Tunji and the island rhythm with Gordy and Zoe. And so this is a kind of fulfillment in that. And when I met, which is included in some of the stories here, the Shona Zimbabwean cultural spirit medium, Shvikiro, they had the same message as Baba, which is one heart, one love. We are one human community. And for some of them, it wasn't so much the black-white, because the whites that would go visit these fikiros already were aware of that. But he said the rich blacks and the poor blacks, the post-colonial white Southern Africans that haven't changed their mindset and aren't aware of it.
Lee, this sounds to me like both a love story and a labor of love. Now, you went about semi-publishing this yourself. Can you tell us a bit about that story?
Yes. Of course, I put it out to some agents and publishers and had a handful of interest. And I think why those didn't come through is because if this had been published a few years ago, it was premature. Because now the story itself is a testament to Black Lives Matter. And the way that I question my identity as a sixth generation Canadian when my forebears were in Ontario in the early 1800s and up cutting down trees in northern BC, and I was born up the coast in the traditional territory of the Heiltsik people. So that ethic and my ever awakening perspective on all of that is woven through the book. So the timing, I think, is better now. And the publisher is Cortez's very own Indie Press, Salmon Berry Arts and Publishing, who was Rex Weiler and Norm Gibbons, Lisa Weiler, and then went dormant for a bit. And then we've resurrected it for this book, and this may not be the first. And it feels absolutely perfect to have this be completely homegrown.
Tell us where we can get our hands on the book.
Marnie's Bookstore.
Okay, on Cortez. And is it possible to order through your website as well?
On my website, there's ordering information.
Okay.
There's a distributor on Vancouver Island who will sell to bookstores and to individuals. It's also on all the online Amazon, Alibris, Barnes & Noble, like that. Oh, here's the reason why it would be great for people to go to the website, orianlee.com with one N. There's photos, and this may interest you as a musician. We created a Spotify soundtrack, and these are 3 hours of music to accompany reading the story, because all the way through music, having formerly been married to a musician and played music with you in the drumming group, and my son is a musician, there were songs that accompanied me, and they run the gamut from a bliss kind of tektronic riding on the beach to Nat King Cole singing Unforgettable to the balcony scene from Romeo and Juliet, and then some Shona ceremonial beer music.
Greg Osoba, Cortez Island.
And that's all for us at Viewpoints. Hope you enjoyed the show. Thanks to our reporters, Sarah Gouda in Halifax, Craig Osoba in Cortes Island, British Columbia, Taylor McClure in Knowlton, Quebec, and Morgan Boudin in Terrace, BC. National Coordinator Maureen McEwen in Ottawa. Viewpoints is produced by the Community Radio Fund of Canada. In Montreal, I'm your host and producer, Boris Chassaigne. It was a pleasure to have you with us. See you next week.
In Kingston, Ontario. You are tuned to Viewpoints. Listen to all our stories online at canada-info.ca and follow us on Twitter at CanadaLJI.